I'm Kara Malenfant with the Association of College and Research Libraries, and this is my colleague David Staley, who's with the Goldberg Center and an adjunct associate professor in the Department of History at The Ohio State University, and we're here to talk with you about the academic library in 2025. And I mentioned to some folks earlier, we have a very short URL we've created if you want to look at the actual research report we'll be discussing. That's www.acrl.org/futures. In addition, I need to remind you all to be sure to complete your evaluation for the entire EDUCAUSE conference and for this session. We'd love to hear your feedback afterwards about what you thought. So, what could academic libraries look like in 2025? And what kinds of actions could librarians take now to plan for a variety of alternate futures? Those are really big questions, and there's no one singular answer. But I hope that today we can give you a little insight into how academic librarians see the future of higher education and what that could mean for you. Last spring, my colleague David and I collaborated to research and write the report Futures Thinking for Academic Librarians, Higher Education in 2025. We conceived of it as a way to help stimulate thinking for members of the Association of College and Research Libraries. So David's going to describe for you a little bit about the process, how the scenarios were constructed, the concept of a scenario space, and kind of what the results might mean. I'll give you a little more background on why ACRL decided to do this, and then we'll jump into some of the scenarios we think that are most interesting and worth discussing with you. And we've paced this to ensure that we have a good amount of time at the end because we'd like some feedback from you all to hear about what else you think might be happening or what else could be coming on the horizon that we all collectively as a community ought to start paying attention to.
I'm curious to know how many in the audience are familiar with or maybe even participated in a scenario planning exercise or know about scenarios. Okay, then maybe not so much explanation, but only to point out that I do this kind of scenario work in some consulting I do, strategic foresight consulting that I do with companies and organizations. And one of the first things I always say to these clients is, anybody that tells you they can predict the future is selling you snake oil. Well, with some caveats of that. I can predict with a fair amount of certainty that it's going to be cold in Minnesota, where Kara is from. It's going to be cold in Minnesota in January. That I can predict, I think, with a fair amount of certainty. But it's also kind of a trivial kind of prediction. The sorts of things that interest us most, I think, are the things that are inherently unpredictable. And so when I talk about scenarios, I make a very clear distinction between a scenario and a prediction. This isn't just, you know, academic or semantic game playing. There really is a conceptual difference. A prediction assumes that you can state the future with absolute certainty. And in fact, the future is already in existence someplace, and all you have to do is to have the right tools in order to discern it. Scenarios are based on a very different kind of conception about the future, and that is, the future isn't already formed someplace. It's formless. There are maybe a limited number of such futures that could exist. But the idea with scenario thinking is to not state the one prediction for the future, but to try to imagine as many plausible variations as you can imagine. We've come up with 26. There are scenario exercises, of course, that are much smaller, on the order of 4 or 5. I was telling Kara last night at dinner, I've seen some scenarios that run into the hundreds, for instance. And if you're going to do that, you need to have some sort of organizing tool. And the one that I like using and the one we used for this process is what I call a scenario space, where we take each one of the 26 scenarios and plot them in the scenario space. And I'll explain in just a moment how we did that. Kara and her team put together the scenarios, did the research and the writing of the different scenarios. And unlike a lot of scenario projects, because we were doing this as through a survey mechanism, the scenarios are quite brief. If you've seen scenarios before, they can sometimes run a page, 2 pages in length. We tried to keep these on the order of no more than, say, 100, 150, 200 words. Short kind of snapshots of potential futures. And scenarios, to be clear, are not sort of single point predictions. In 2015, this is going to happen. Scenarios are meant to be sort of a description of an environment or an ecosystem in which our decisions will take place. So Kara and her team devised 26 of these scenarios. They tried to, and I think successfully, to look not just simply at very highly probable scenarios, but also tried to get members of ACRL to consider wildcard scenarios. And I'll talk a bit more about those in just a second. We created a survey instrument where we asked the participants, and the total number of participants we had was
just over 400.
400. So it was a fairly large N, much larger than I've ever done with this kind of exercise. And for each one of the scenarios, we asked them to rate it or to make a judgment about it based on four criteria or four dimensions of this space. The first is, what's the impact of the scenario on libraries and the academic community generally? And that ran from, you know, no impact to game changer. And then we asked them to consider the probability of the scenario occurring. Now, probability here isn't a statistical probability. This is expert judgment probability. What's your sense of the likelihood of this scenario occurring? And again, likelihood in a sort of an objective sense, in the sense that we weren't asking them, would you like to see this happen, or would you prefer to see this happen? We were very, very clear that we're not talking here about preferred futures. We're trying to get as realistic assessment of the lay of the land as possible. We asked, and those are plotted here, as you can see, as the X and Y axes. Then we asked each participant to consider, what's the speed of change? Is this something that's going to be occurring in the next 5 years? Is this something that's going to take to 2025 to happen? And the size of the number of the scenario gives you a sense of the speed of change. Finally, we asked participants, does this scenario represent a threat or an opportunity for academic libraries? And that's represented by color here. Red, or various shades of red, obviously is a threat. Green is an opportunity. And this is the result we had then for the 26 scenarios. We're going to break these out so that you'll have a clearer picture. But it gives you a sense of how this group, at any rate, viewed the likelihood of various of these various scenarios. And we'll talk here in just a second about how you use this scenario space as a way to think about strategic planning.
So why did ACRL get into this? Why did we decide this would be an interesting project to do? Actually, it came about because of a comment in another meeting we had convened last July, where we asked some folks to come together and think about how academic libraries could best demonstrate their value, show that they're contributing to student learning, show that they're aiding in student success or faculty productivity and whatnot. And the result of that is a three-year initiative, which we recently launched, and many of you may have seen the Value of Academic Libraries report that Megan Oakleaf just put out. So that's ongoing. But during that meeting, a senior academic officer outside the library said, well, it's not enough to know what higher education values or what the academy or what colleges value in their libraries now. We have to start thinking about what will be valued in the future so that librarians can make plans to meet that kind of a future. And that just really piqued my interest. I thought, wow, how do you do that? How do you understand what might be valuable in the future? So we decided to do some futures research, and we found David, and we worked through this process with him. So while ACRL has recently released that comprehensive review around the question of value that says where we are now, what we know, what we don't know now, this futures report serves as sort of a companion to tell us some things about what might be coming down the line and what that might mean for libraries. We thought in doing this report that it would be good to look further out. And in fact, the ACRL leadership gave us that direction. They said, we really want you to look 15 years out. We think it's not enough to look 3 years or 5 years. We think people feel too constrained by our current budget climate, too worried about, you know, massive journal cancellations or staff layoffs. It's hard in that environment to free up your thinking and exercise your imagination if you're only asking people about 5 years. So look 15 years out. So that's what we aimed to do. We thought it would free up thinking, help people think about what might happen further down the road. And we made a conscious decision in administering the survey to reach out to all kinds of librarians. We weren't interested only in what library directors thought, or only people who'd been in the profession a certain length of time, or only people in certain kinds of institutions. So the demographic profile of our respondents matches up almost exactly with the demographic profile of a typical ACRL membership. Different types of institutions, different lengths of time in the profession, and different job titles. So based on that feedback, we created the scenario space, and David's going to dive into some of the specific scenarios now. But to help us all think about 15 years out, I find it useful to think about 15 years back as sort of a way of realizing what a large span of time that really is. So I invite you all now to think about where you were in October of 1995. So the national news headlines were reporting on the Unabomber Manifesto, the sarin gas attacks in Tokyo, and the Oklahoma City bombing was still very raw for all of us. The final cartoon strip of Calvin and Hobbes was being published. Tom Hanks won an Oscar for Forrest Gump. And Superman, Christopher Reeves, was just paralyzed, which was crushing for me. He was such a childhood hero of mine. In terms of technology, let me share a couple anecdotes from my own personal life. I had been out of college for a few years, and I was working for an office in Washington, D.C., where I was considered an absolute computer whiz because I understood how to do a mail merge. That was considered, like, very significant. And it was kind of ironic because I'd been a Peace Corps volunteer. I'd been living in a country with no electricity and very little running water for the 2 years prior. So to think that someone could be out of the loop for 2 years and come back and be considered at the vanguard now seems just ridiculous. But I'd had a really good college that had some of the very first Next computer stations. I'd had a great internship in college as well, so I understood sort of the tools and technologies. I also understood what email was and how to use it, and I was the one person in the office who really got it. So I was tasked with managing the one email account. So I would come in the morning, pull up all the emails, print them out, and walk around and hand them to people's inboxes. And then I would come back at lunch and take their disks with all the responses, and then I would send them out. And it was really frustrating for me. I was like, people, this isn't the point. This isn't how it's supposed to work. But for them, it was great that I understood it and could do that. So lots has changed in 15 years in our society, in our culture, certainly in terms of technology. And who knows how much more change can come 15 years out. But now let's take a little journey into the future.
Well, and just to highlight a point that Kara was making there, one of the things that really struck me about ACRL's interest in this is not so much, you know, that we have to get the future correct, right? That we have to have predictive certainty. That oftentimes in scenario exercises like this, the idea really is to free up thinking, to think differently, to reimagine processes, to get out of the habit of thinking about just the present, and especially if you're going to do strategic planning. It's really important, I think, to consider scenario exercises like this. As I said, based on the survey research, we plotted the scenarios in the scenario space. The quadrant in the upper right corner there, that's the region that this group, at least, adjudged to be high probability, high impact scenarios. And whenever I do this exercise, I say, you look at these scenarios, if you've judged these to be highly likely and they're going to have this dramatic change or just this dramatic impact on your businesses, then due diligence would require that your strategic planning be taking consideration of these, that you can't ignore them, right, if they've been adjudged in this fashion. So I wanted to look at a couple of these and to give you a sense of the sorts of scenarios that were located up here. The increasing threat of cyber war and cyber crime and cyber terrorism, that libraries are going to have to deal with this, that college and university library and the IT systems at libraries are the targets of hackers and criminals and rogue states even, and that the disruptions occur for days and weeks at a time. We think right now of cyber attacks as being against, you know, other countries or something like that, but this is a scenario about cyber attacks and cyber crime being more commonplace among a whole slew of organizations. Librarians struggle to maintain patron privacy and face increasing scrutiny and criticism as they seek to preserve online intellectual freedom in this climate. The standard in writing scenarios is to write about them as if you were in the present. So that's why we use the presence here. And librarians, not surprisingly, saw this largely as a threat and one that was coming quite fast. The change is coming quite fast. The new freshman class. They've had laptops in their hands since they were 18 months old. And so the students, especially who come from privileged social and economic backgrounds, are completely fluent in digital media. For many others, the digital divide, parental unemployment, and the disruption of moving about during the foreclosure crisis means they never became really tech savvy. Remedial computer and information literacy courses are now de rigueur. And again, librarians saw this as an opportunity and also a trend or a scenario that was coming particularly quickly. Right here with me, students talk through homework with their handheld devices, which issues alerts when passing a bookstore with material they need to cite. Scanning the title page, this information is instantly embedded in proper citation style with added endnotes. Checking in on location-based services, students locate study team members and hold impromptu meetings without the need for study rooms. Their devices have whiteboards and can share notes with absent members. Again, librarians saw this largely as an opportunity and a particularly fast-moving scenario. Scholarship stultifies, seen as an opportunity. The systems that reward faculty members continue to favor conventionally published research. At the same time, standard dissemination channels, especially the university press, start to implode. While many academic libraries actively host and support online journals, monographs, and other digital scholarly products, their stature is not great. Collegial culture continues to value tradition over anything perceived as risky. And just as an aside to this, I've been wrestling with the issues of digital scholarship for about 15 years now, and I'm amazed that we're still having discussions about the value of this kind of research as scholarship. In my discipline, history, we're still debating electronic scholarship and whether or not it's useful or capable of being used for tenure and promotion purposes. And I'm seeing some quizzical looks. It's true. 2010, we are still wrestling with this issue. The academy changes very slowly, and this scenario sort of continues that process even further. The textbook monopoly is broken. Many states have passed legislation in this scenario that requires textbook publishers to make textbooks affordable. Faculty, sympathetic to their students, have embraced open educational resources. More and more faculty create and share their own course materials, share these openly. Although widely accepted, OER exists only for introductory courses. Faculty create these materials for advanced courses based on their own knowledge and interests and invite student contributions as well. There were some open-ended comments here that were of interest. Do you want to draw on some of these? Or?
Sure. There were actually, we included in the report quotes from the librarians, and I would encourage you to go back and hear their voices, because what we were interested in was their perceptions, what they thought. So in this particular case around the textbook monopoly, this was one of the 26 that had just a ton of open-ended comments. People were really interested in talking about this scenario. And some people saw that this is already happening in some fields, at some institutions. It's a positive move, but it radically impacts and changes the way we do things in academia and in the library. So we need to start rethinking now and help lead our colleagues at our institution in determining policies. So that seems to be, in that person's mind, a real opportunity for librarians to partner differently with faculty and maybe even with technologists in helping to support OER and propel that movement forward. A second person said, this is an excellent opportunity for librarians to prove their worth as information collectors, organizers, and evaluators. And they give the case of using lib guides by course and subject that allow professors to select alternative curriculum materials. It's an excellent way for librarians to once again become an essential part of the planning process.
And those comments, we include at least a selection of those in the report. So if you're flipping through the report, you can see some of those. And they were very helpful, and we're still trying to find ways to data mine those for insights. This scenario, open peer review, becomes the norm for many fields. And again, librarians see this as an opportunity, especially for librarians to become more highly involved in the peer reviewing process. Scenario 10 was everyone is a non-traditional student. And in fact, we were having this discussion in a session yesterday. Maybe the word non-traditional isn't going to apply any longer, because instead of non-traditional, we'll call them typical students, that the typical student won't be 18 to 22 years of age, being away from home for the first time, that everyone is a non-traditional student in this scenario. I see what you see is the impact of things like large touch screens. These become positioned beneath cameras and projectors and become standard equipment in campus computing labs and local public libraries, and for a fee at stores in the same way that we think of photocopiers in stores today. That we'll see these sorts of large touchscreen tables. Tables read and respond to items placed on them, changing distance learning for fields like engineering, architecture, GIS. Group design visual projects happen easily when students are distributed across space, and these touch screens allow simultaneous use. And a scenario for the impact of corporatization. At for-profit institutions, education is disaggregated and very competitive. Students are no longer graduate from one school, but pick and choose like a progressive dinner party. I love that phrasing. That's Kara's phrasing. Schools increasingly specialize by offering online courses that cater to particular professional groups. Certificate courses explode and are sponsored by vendors of products to particular professions.
If I could just interject, the reason there's a race car up there is one of the comments really just drew this out. My president has said that he wants this college to look like a NASCAR car, have partnership labels plastered all over it. We pay more attention to what the partners in industry have to say than what the faculty says. Faculty can be censured for jeopardizing lucrative partnerships. In two-year schools and business colleges, this is probably now the norm. So in some of these cases, you know, when we were writing this, we thought, gosh, I wonder if this would happen and how it would happen and how fast it would happen. And this person's telling us it's already happening right now in my institution.
Now, William Gibson said the future already exists, it's just not distributed evenly. And that's something that we saw in a lot of these scenarios, I think, that it may not be happening at every institution, but the assumption underlying each one of these scenarios is that this is the new normal, right? The assumption is this is what normal is 15 years in the future. These nine were the ones that we found to be particularly high impact, particularly fast changing, and in the report, we advise library directors that as you think about your strategic planning, that you take these into account. When I do this kind of work with companies, one of the techniques we do is we test corporate strategy against a number of these scenarios. And the idea is not to optimize your strategy against any one scenario, but to develop a robust strategy that's good enough across a number of these scenarios. And that way what you're developing is not, you develop a strategy that is malleable, better able to cope, and not brittle as a strategy, as conditions change that you hadn't considered. The whole point of scenario-based exercises like this is to eliminate what is called strategic surprise, or the I never saw it coming scenario, right? Well, we never could have seen the levee breaking in New Orleans. Well, in fact, there were some scenarios that did exactly that. So the whole point of scenario space exercises like this is to expand awareness, expand especially peripheral vision. So these are the scenarios that are high impact, high probability. What about the rest of the scenario space? What do we do with the others? In particular, I have organizations focus on the upper left-hand quadrant as well, to not lose sight of the upper left-hand quadrant. These are scenarios that are judged to be high impact were they to occur, but their probability is much smaller, less likely. In the futuring business, we call those wild cards, black swans, the I never saw it coming scenarios. And part of the reason why organizations don't see them coming is that they haven't gone through a process where they've at least thought about the possibility. I'm not expecting organizations to actively pursue these. We have to change our strategic thinking now to take these into account. But think of these as sort of strategic peripheral vision. In the same way, our ocular peripheral vision allows us to see things on the periphery, right? I don't have to respond to that kid over here as I'm driving, but the minute I see the ball cross into my field of vision, then I stop the car. And that is one of the things about these scenarios, about a scenario space. Revisit this in 6 months and see if the scenarios have moved around in that space. I wanted to give you a sense of what some of these wildcard scenarios were. Community over consumerism. Simple living takes hold. Community is more valuable than money. And students embrace distance ed as a way to reduce their carbon footprint. Longevity becomes the new wealth. Seniors, and here we're talking about retired baby boomers, seniors pursue intellectual passions they previously put off and return home to their colleges, to their alma mater, the campuses of their youth, to start to take classes, all the classes that they put off because of work and family and career. Sign on the dotted line. Librarians no longer hold tenure and are rewarded for creating new tools, patented to universities, increasing enrollment, retention, and bringing in grants. Again, this is not what we want to see happen, but it's a scenario we want librarians to think about. Many librarians saw this as a fast-moving scenario. college degree for every citizen. Education is so valued that a national debate emerges over universal higher education in the way we're today talking about universal health care. Academic niche networking. Hyper-specialization of professions causes a breakdown of traditional academic departments, and students study only highly specialized courses. In fact, part of the scenario is I get a degree in 19th century British history. That's my degree, not that I've taken a whole host of other courses, general education courses, anything like that. I get a degree just in that. That's academic niche networking. Archives on demand. Affordable 3D printers are ubiquitous. And we heard about fab technology, I think, yesterday, right? Students print off objects from distant archives and museums. So instead of don't touch the objects, print off your own copy and touch to your heart's content. No need to search is this scenario. And again, these are all wild card scenarios, but content-aware software inserts high-quality and vetted information. Students focus on synthesis, analysis, and interpretation. And a really dire scenario, right? Information companies supplant the academic library, and institutions outsource all the other remaining library functions. Again, not a scenario we want to see, but a scenario we wanted ACRL members to consider. Pop-up campuses. Because they are given to online learning, few physical campuses remain. Most institutions exist virtually, and if anything, maybe if they exist physically, they're like pop-up spaces. They're around for 3 or 4 months, in the same way that the Halloween store or the Christmas store pops up in your local mall for 3 months and then it's gone. So that campuses could also pop up like that, and their physical presence is reduced. Something like the Renaissance. Academics take a holistic approach to research, yielding action-based answers to enduring riddles. That we create something like Renaissance Florence in our universities. Think you. Visualization and other forms of non-textual ways of representing knowledge dominate, and the value, the role of text and words starts to diminish. Again, not necessarily a scenario we want to see. And these were some scenarios that were even lower impact than that. Again, as you look through the report, pay attention to these scenarios that are located in this peripheral region. High impact, but less probability. And again, revisit them in 6 months and ask yourself if the possibility is more likely. Ask yourself in a year, have we seen a change in the environment that makes these scenarios more likely? And then consider yourself forewarned.
So we hope that hearing about some of these scenarios was stimulating for you. If you want to engage your colleagues back home in this kind of exercise and thinking through some of these scenarios, the report contains a suggested activity at the back, a way you could gather colleagues together and host a meeting and start doing some of this kind of thinking on your own. So we expected and endeavored to challenge the mental models of librarians who answered and responded to our scenarios. And perhaps we've challenged some of yours as well. By reflecting on alternate futures, we hoped that people would see their own strategic assumptions and their own values in a new light. The report, again, was intended to provide a stimulus for thinking about and managing change differently. It wasn't intended to predict anything, any one thing would happen. And it seems that we've succeeded in terms of providing a stimulus for thinking about change, because a lot of the respondents indicated that they sort of got that point, and librarians in many of the scenarios saw opportunities, even in ones that I would have thought were dire. They said, oh, this is only a threat if the library doesn't do, and then would proceed to come up with a solution of how the library could have a central role. So here are a few general comments I wanted to share so that you can hear the voices of academic librarians and how they view the future. They said, generally, it's good to think around the corners. Change, while a little unnerving, is inevitable and gives us opportunities to be creative and increase our relevancy. Almost any scenario could be turned into an opportunity for the academic library with enough vision. It seems like the future of the academic library certainly lies in the academic librarian becoming more and more of a creator and a curator, trading in the passive role for a much more active and collaborative one. Very exciting. And a third person said, the scenarios were thought-provoking, and a few of them were hard to comment on, as I hadn't imagined them before. This survey helped me identify some possible topics that will affect the profession for years to come. Not necessarily that they will happen, but just the idea that some aspects of them could happen was really interesting for me. So again, we hope we've given you something to think about, and we'd like to have some time for open discussion. We'd like to hear any of the reactions you have to the 9 scenarios we presented at the beginning. Do you see any implications for your libraries or for other kinds of libraries? Were there other wild card scenarios that you think could be coming that we as a profession ought to start thinking about and planning for? And then I'd be curious to know if anybody's used this report yet in their own library, if anybody tried the activity. And we're open to just any kind of questions or comments or challenges that you might have. And we'd ask that you please do use the microphones because the session's being recorded. We want to be sure anyone who's remotely can hear you.
I'm sure this is in the report that I haven't read, but could you describe the process that you used to develop the scenarios?
Sure. We undertook about 2 months of pretty intensive environmental scanning. And we, sure. So what we did was we tried to look very far outside of our own profession and our own professional literature. We looked for just things that are sort of could be fringe trends out there in the world. So, for example, I read this magazine called Streetwise, which homeless people sell in Chicago. I made sure I read Streetwise every week for two months to find out what they were saying. I read Golf Digest. We read, you know, just about anything, any blog postings we could find. You forwarded lots of interesting little snippets to me as well. But the point was to look outside of libraries, to look outside of higher education, to really look broadly and to try to see what kinds of signals we were finding. So I saw a little snippet somewhere about education potentially, or professions changing, and that there was some movement within the medical profession now to have not just surgeons, and not just surgeons who specialize on joints, and not just surgeons who specialize on knees, but surgeons who specialize on knee injuries specifically from football. And I thought, wow, what if that were something that became more common? How would that affect how we teach? And that's where that part of the academic niche networking then came out of that one little reference I read somewhere in some report. So that was how we did it. We gathered all this information, and then I worked with my colleagues at ACRL, with Catherine Dias, with Mary Jane Petrowski, and with David Free, and we had several writing exercises where we would come up with a topic, and then I would provide them the topic and several citations we had found that were related to the topic, and then we just did free writing exercises, discuss them, debate them, sort of what seemed way too far-fetched that it wasn't even possible, you know, and what seemed to have some degree of probability, and then we winnowed them down. David and I went back and forth and said, wow, there's a lot of great ones we could use, but we know we can't ask people to consider this many, so we had to winnow them down.
Yeah, I think we had 40 at one stage, and that's just, I think, unmanageable. Yeah.
And we did do a pilot test with people to see sort of, you know, when did they drop out, how many could they manage to respond to, at what point did their interest start to wane, and sort of broke things up that way. Does that answer your question?
As a non-librarian, I'm interested if you thought about running these scenarios through non-librarians and what kind of differences you might find in the responses. Because I was thinking as I heard some of these that, you know, here's someone trying to figure out how to reinvent their job to keep it, you know, and being in IT where you have many situations where departments said, hey, I don't need the central IT department anymore, I'm going to do it myself. I think it would be very interesting to, you know, in the world where the central cataloging and indexing, to know what the role of a local library might be as compared to some general library or libraries one could subscribe to, and, you know, what the faculty think.
You know, I was going to ask if you had a specific stakeholder group in mind, and I think it would be fascinating to find out what faculty think.
Yeah.
I think it would be just fascinating.
And I might mention I'm from UC Merced, which is a new campus, and we have very few paper books. And the librarians spend a lot of time negotiating licenses with the journals. And I think a lot of their energy goes more towards licensing, which at the end of the day, you know, isn't a particularly librarian, you know, kind of profession. And a lot less on the traditional roles, even though they're doing so many interesting things. But I think there's some very profound changes when publishing is electronic and cataloging and indexing is done by, you know, centrally. I just think other people might see this very differently.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think I'm actually working on a PhD, and that's where I'm headed with my dissertation, is to better understand faculty perspectives and to work with librarians to try to see if they can collectively as a group figure out what to do with that. You know, if we better understand faculty perspectives, what does that mean for us and how we operate? So,
are you using this study as the jumping off point?
I haven't completely set up my methods yet for my dissertation, but I think some of these scenarios will reappear. I think we might winnow the list down and find some about higher education writ large, and then ask faculty their perceptions, and maybe even do some smaller discussion groups with them to sort of dig a little deeper. That was one thing we couldn't do in this report. We couldn't dig very deep with people in just a survey to really, you know, to find out what was beneath those comments. For example, if people thought 3D printing wasn't going to happen, that you weren't going to be able to print archives on demand, why did they think that wasn't going to happen? Was it because they didn't believe that the technology exists? Well, because it does. Or was it because they thought it wouldn't be scalable? Or was it because they thought students wouldn't use it that way? They would use it for other uses? So we weren't able to dig beneath and find out sometimes why people thought something would be probable or not probable, or why people thought something would have a particularly high impact or low impact. So I'd like to go back and revisit some of these again. Do other folks have questions or reactions or ideas about what great next research question we could ask?
So I wanted to, I guess, comment maybe question one. What I would say was a kind of a throwaway comment you made when you talked about tenure of librarians and how you hoped that wouldn't happen, or librarians hoped that wouldn't happen. And I really wonder if this is that moment where we see higher education coming under a lot more scrutiny to say, why is tenure important? You know, if we are trying to balance the need for academic freedom with having a way to measure people's ability to meet the needs of faculty, students, and staff, you know, where does tenure fall in that? Mm-hmm. And I wonder how much the report reflects kind of a head-in-the-sand approach of, well, that's a high impact, but it's not really probable because I really hope it's not going to happen.
Let me respond to this, because you've raised a good point. When I talk about scenario space, I'm very clear to say, and I'll state it clearly here, scenario space is not a map of the future. It is a map of our perceptions about the future. And so that's what you're looking at here. So I think your observation, your question is a valid one, and that's part of that drilling down that Kara wants to investigate. Do we really think that there's low probability of this occurring, sort of objectively, or is that more of our own wishful thinking? Right. Of course, I want tenure to remain. When I talk about impacts and probabilities, and we talk about scenarios, what we're talking about here is the external environment. Kara very nicely explained the environment that she was scanning, and what we're talking about is the environment over which we have very little control. Right. Internally, I suppose I don't have much control internally either. But at least I have, you know, I control a budget, I control, you know, hiring personnel. There are things I can control. So if I can make a statement about the future, I can say I'm going to hire 2 new staff members next year. Okay, because I have a certain amount of control over that. Whether or not for-profit companies come to dominate the market, I don't have direct control over that. And I think that's where tenure falls into. I think that's where I think it falls into that latter case. How much control do we actually have over this process? Some, to be sure, but how much is beyond our control? These scenarios are as much about trying to understand, to capture, to put our minds around that larger environment over which we have little or no control. Do you want to add anything to that?
No, I just would agree. I mean, I think it's a great question, and I think the head in the sand thing might be part of it. I mean, it might be people's aspirations rather than or wishful thinking rather than, you know, a more objective assessment of what might happen.
I hope librarians read this and think, boy, I've never really considered this before. Maybe I need to be more diligent about our privileges because I'd always just sort of assumed them.
Or better able to articulate why it's important. Why does that matter? You know, why should that continue? What are some reasons we can clearly state that it's important and in a convincing way?
Before you came to the session today, had anybody used the report, had read the report before and used it in their own institutions? No one had?
Some of the others of you who earlier indicated you've done scenario thinking or scenario planning before, I'd like to just wonder how this meshed with processes that you've used, because there are different futurists have different ways of approaching scenario thinking and scenario planning. So how did you use it before in your libraries, and how was it useful?
That's right.
If anyone could care to share that with us.
I'm from an Australian library, and we certainly have been doing this sort of work in some of our libraries, and certainly in my library at the University of Melbourne in Victoria. And we're quite a large university, and so we've been going through this process over the last few years, looking at different scenarios, thinking out. We did a lot of planning and a lot of talking to our students, talking to our academics, finding out what their expectations were, what they wanted from the library, and developed different scenarios from that and sort of tagged it Library of the Future. Mm-hmm. And so we really got people engaged in that discussion, and so we're still using some of that information that we came up with a couple of years ago, but we keep revisiting it. So it's a thing that we're doing on a reasonably regular basis, and some of those things that we thought about a few years ago actually have come to fruition, so we're dealing with them right now. So, yeah, so working through the same sorts of processes that you did.
And how did you engage your students and your faculty? How did you work with them to understand what they were thinking?
We sort of went round to each faculty. They each have what they call faculty board meetings, and so then we engaged the academics. So we went and did a presentation and then invited them to come and work with us in different ways, and we got people that wanted to do that. We ran some general sessions with students. We actually approached students through the different student union associations and things like that and engaged groups of students that way and offered them, you know, either a free coffee or, you know, things like that to try and encourage them to come along. Usually with the academics, we try and hold it over lunchtime, offer a sandwich lunch. We were more likely to get them and to come in and have those discussions with us. So we did get quite a bit of engagement, and it was really fruitful.
Great. And just another question, were you focusing more on the future of the library when you were talking with them, or was it? Well, did it also include broadly the future of higher education?
A bit of both. Okay. I mean, we were looking at where the library sat in the future of higher education, and so what our students were wanting from us, what their expectations were of the library, and I think we're a little bit surprised that so many of them still had strong feelings about having a strong physical presence for the library, which we thought a lot of them, you know, they want the online access anytime, you know, they can get their resources anytime, anywhere. They wanted everything digitised. But they still wanted that sense of place, and they still wanted a physical presence.
What did they want in that physical presence? Is it coffee shops, or is it...
Well, yes, they did want more of that. I mean, but our campus has lots of coffee shops.
Sure.
And we're in an area of Melbourne that's renowned for really good coffee. It's a predominantly Italian sort of restaurant area, so we have really good coffee. So that's not an issue. So, I mean, the things that they were wanting is to extend the wireless connectivity off the main campus and out into the coffee shops and restaurants. That's what they wanted.
Yeah.
They wanted things like that. They said they wanted to be able to go over to their favourite little coffee shop or restaurant and still be able to access and have connectivity back to the campus. So that was an expectation. And, I mean, I'm not sure if people are aware, but we do have some major issues with broadband in Australia. It's not as good as it is in Europe and the US. So, I mean, it's a political thing that's going on at the moment. But, yes, they wanted that, but they still wanted to be able to come to the library, know that they could access the collections that they needed, that they had spaces that they could work in groups or they could have their individual study. A lot of postgraduates particularly wanted, they felt that the library had been taken over by undergraduates and was becoming a noisy place, and which is great from an undergraduate perspective, but the postgraduate said, we want more quieter spaces that are dedicated to us to do our work. So, yeah.
Well, thank you. Thanks for sharing. We have a few minutes left, I think, if others have questions or comments or want to share how they've used the scenario thinking.
We've had similar focus groups, and those kinds of focus groups, you hear about perceived deficiencies of, you know, things that they wish they had now, and their future by, you know, by virtue of the fact you don't have them, and, you know, you could do some of them in the future. You know, for example, 24-hour access to everything. I mean, that's, or increased wireless. That's the kind of thing we expect to find out talking to our students and faculty. They're really not focusing strategically, you know, as you have. You started this by talking about the period 15 years ago and how different it was. And I'm curious, maybe you've done some research on this. What were the futurists saying 15 years ago about today? How accurate is this kind of exercise in retrospect?
You know, there was something I saw on USA Today yesterday, Alvin Toffler, Future Shock 40 years ago, and how many things have come true. So, you know, I think sometimes those predictions do come true and sometimes they don't. I think, you know, the main thing for us in this exercise was we weren't trying to predict that something would come true. It was really about thinking differently, opening up your imagination, and a different way of strategic thinking. A lot of times we do strategic planning that's very linear and sequential. a single line trajectory. So this introduces ways of thinking about uncertainty and preparing for that.
Someone wiser than I called these rehearsals of the future, and I like that. Sir?
I'm wondering why the coming of the age of information abundance, Google Book, or the universal library on the net didn't make it on the list. Is that because it happened already?
The simple answer is yes. And also because it was a little too obvious. It would be like having a scenario about the budget situation, for instance. And the idea was to sort of think beyond the immediate present. That said, we did get some responses back that asked, that was certainly one of them. Where's Google? Where's the universal searchable library? And the other one was just about books, the status of books and e-readers and those sorts of things. And so I don't know if I'm spilling too much, but we're planning similar kinds of research reports on both of those, the future of books and the future of the universal library. I just don't have a timetable for those yet.
And I think you'll also notice very few of the scenarios directly talked about libraries. We purposefully tried not to make that a focus. We were looking at other factors. So we did throw a few in there just so people could connect. But we tried to not focus on the future of the library, but the future of higher education and the environment outside that would affect higher education.
But it's a fair observation.
Yeah, very, very, very fair.
Your time?
We probably have time for one more question. I think we've got about 2 minutes. If anybody else has anything they'd like to say or share or ask.
I think there must be something in the air. I'm from a university in the UK, and we're also involved in a...
Yeah, you guys have been doing... UK has been doing a lot of scenario work.
Yes, Libraries of the Future.
Yeah.
And I was quite interested in the way in which you approach the backcasting. Now, we did that, but we also involved academics, members from the government, members from funding bodies, alongside a representative group of librarians. And the other comment I wanted to make was that in your low probability but high impact, there were two that we actually put in our high probability and high impact, and they're around the outsourcing model and the development of shared services and the move towards looking at national procurement, not just, as you know, in the UK, we have national procurement for a range of journals and bundles of stuff, but equally for LMS systems, looking at repositories, looking at various different types of functional systems that underpin the work of university libraries. Now, we're at the stage where the consultants that we've employed have come up with four different scenarios, and they're testing them with students and with faculty members across, again, a demographic range of institutions. So we're really interested to see where, you know, the findings from both reports come together.
Yeah.
It's just a comment.
Very interesting. Thank you. And it'll be fascinating to find out where the points of convergence and divergence are with your student groups and your faculty groups. Is your report available? Are you talking about the GIST report, or which one are you talking about, and is it available, someone's asking? It's not available yet, is what I'm hearing.
No, the report will come out probably next year. They're taking a two-year, and in fact, actually, we've got a scenario of 2050.
Wow.
So it's quite some way in the future. But we've worked up, and as I say, there were four different main scenarios, but the process that we employed was very similar to yourselves, and very exciting, actually, having people's perspectives from a range of different occupations within higher education and outside coming together and coming up with the four scenarios. Of course, in the UK, we had one scenario which was referred to as the walled garden, and I don't expect there are many surprises for considering how that might look. So you'd have within that, you know, the iconoclastic Oxbridge universities, those that have cultural significance in their own right, the equivalent maybe of the Ivy League. And then there would be this melting pot of different partnerships evolving over time, much like the notion of having the student doing the pick and mix of various different classes and modules and degree opportunities from across not just the UK but the world. We then had a Wild West scenario, which was pretty much the polar opposite of that, where everything is outsourced. Everything is privately funded. There's very little public funding going into higher education, and it's marketplace driven. And then there were two that sat largely in the middle of that. But as I say, that came from discussions with not just librarians, but with a much broader spectrum of participants. Okay.
Thank you.
I eagerly await that report.
Yeah, sounds fascinating. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're out of time, but I'd encourage you all again to remember to complete your evaluation and to enjoy the rest of the session. And you can be in touch with either of us if you have questions or want to continue the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you all very much.